The midway point of an election day that's set to possibly break records and make history for certain. Break records because there is a record amount of early voting plus in-person voting expected. Early voting, 84 million people. Hello, everyone. I'm François Picard reporting from the U.S. Capitol on this special edition of the France 24 debate, making history. Whoever the next president of the United States is, whether Donald Trump returns to power or Kamala Harris becomes the first woman ever elected to the job, we'll know. We don't know when we'll know, but certainly France 24's coverage will be throughout. It's been an arduous, vitriolic, tense campaign. We saw tension in the streets of Washington, D.C., and we had radically different messages at the last campaign rallies on Monday night. Radically different messages, and in both instances, one aim: to get out the vote.
My last rally, can you believe it? The rallies, these big, beautiful rallies, there's never been anything like it. And there never will be anything like it. And it just happened. It caught on.
Our campaign has tapped into the ambitions and the aspirations and the dreams of the American people. We are optimistic and we are excited about what we can do together. And we know it is time for a new generation of leadership in America.
The U.S. Vice President speaking in the city of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, which will be key to her victory hopes. Let's go to Pennsylvania and France 24's Jessica Lemesurier, who was at that rally. Jessica.
I was one of the 30,000 or so people at that rally, and really there was an atmosphere of optimism, of joy, of hope, particularly amongst the young black women who I spoke to there. They are hoping that the United States is going to get its first female black president. Now, Harris has an awful lot of support in cities like Philadelphia. Where she has less support in Pennsylvania is in rural areas. They tend to vote Republican. And one of her concerns in this election is that in some of these suburban areas, she may have lost some pockets of support. I'm in a suburb of Philadelphia right now, Bucks County, which in the past two elections went to the Democrats. But in this particular area, Levittown, where I am, there are pockets of strong Republican support. If you drive around the streets here, you see an awful lot of Trump signs. And if those signs translate into people going to the polls and voting for Trump, then it's possible that we could see support for him going up in suburban areas of cities. That said, it's very hard to tell, and it's neck and neck still for both candidates in Pennsylvania. Now, I've been talking to voters here, and almost all of them at these two polling stations that I'm next to have told me that they are voting for Donald Trump. Some have been expressing their opinions very loudly. They're concerned about the economy. They say they're hard-working people and they believe that it's only Donald Trump who can save America. They think that America is going in the wrong direction. There was one man who drove up in a bright green sports car with a rap song blaring out of the car, which had expletives that I can't repeat, but also had the phrase Trump 2024. And he was adamant that Trump is going to win Pennsylvania and that he has a lot more support here, in part because a lot of Republicans, he said, went to cast mail-in ballots, more so, he said, than last time. And certainly the queues have not been that long here for in-person voting. And Trump supporters explained to me that this is because many people went and did those mail-in ballots ahead of time.
Jessica Lemesurier reporting live there from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And they'll be, of course, allowed to stay online if they're inside of a polling station when those polls close. We're now in the company of a first-time voter, first-time citizen, freshman in college at the University of Maryland, Peter Andrews. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You voted already?
Yeah, I voted mail-in ballot. It was, I'd say, a stressful process. I wanted to make sure I did everything correctly, and I was very excited when I got the text today saying they had received my ballot, and I was very happy to see that.
So you got a confirmation.
I got a confirmation that they had received the ballot, and I'm glad everything went well. I made sure to go over it, review it multiple times, just make sure I did everything correctly.
All right. So, yeah, there's been one of the concerns has been whether early voting is safe. There's been all kinds of questions on all sides. Poll watchers under a lot of pressure. Peter, you're from a demographic which traditionally doesn't vote as much as the rest of the population. How about this time? How does it feel on your campus?
I feel like this election has really proved how important the young vote is, especially in the swing states where I believe that many of the undecided voters are young voters because they are coming into politics. Their opinions are new and being forged here. And I think this is, all of the young voters I have talked to are deeply opinionated. And I think the reason that there's a stereotype around young voters not being being apathetic about politics and just not caring is that for a long time we felt that there is just no ability to get our opinions out there, no way to...
But this time people are energized. Yeah, why?
I think it was the change from Biden to Kamala that really energized the Democratic, young Democratic voters, because... After the debate between Biden and Trump, I was annoyed. I was angry because it was horrible, and I thought we're just gonna lose this thing, and they're not good. And we all thought that, but no one was listening to us. We felt no one was listening to us. But then Kamala, Biden stepped down, and Kamala stepped up, and I think that change really lit a fire under young Democratic voters to get them out there.
And just briefly, are you noticing a difference between how young men and young women vote? Are there more young men voting for Donald Trump among the people you know?
I'd say definitely more young men. Yeah, I know a few young men. I don't know any young women who are voting personally. I have seen young women who are voting for Trump and young men. The main argument for them is always the economy. They never really address any of his other points. But with Kamala, I feel like I've seen an even amount. I guess I've seen more vote for Trump, but there's no gender gap in who I know voting for Kamala.
All right. I suspect you'll be with your friends watching those returns. Mm-hmm. Peter Andrews, thank you so much for being with us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
So there you have it. Peter Andrews there talking about that gender divide, differences in attitude. Peter explaining to us that he sent his ballot in by mail. One man who's voting on the day is the former U.S. President, Donald Trump. He did so in Florida, where we can go to Kedavan Gorgestani. Kedavan, what's the latest where you are?
Well, as you said, Donald Trump has now voted near his resort of Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach. We're actually standing in front of the Palm Beach County Convention Center. That's behind me, that building where the Republican watch party is going to take place and where Donald Trump is expected to arrive late in the evening. Of course, probably depending on where we are in terms of results. But other than voting for Donald Trump today was spent mostly at Mar-a-Lago. We're told from people inside his campaign that that's where he's going to be most of the day, and he'll only come to the convention center later on. But the person in the campaign that our team spoke to earlier today seemed very confident in the results and very confident that Donald Trump was going to win. And that's something that we heard from Donald Trump himself after he cast his ballot. He was speaking to reporters and he said, we've basically had a much better campaign than both in 2016 and 2020. This is the best campaign we've had in the three campaigns. And he said that he was very happy with the latest results, with the turnout. So it's a very confident Donald Trump and very confident Trump campaign that is getting ready to watch those results come in just the way we do.
Ketevan Gorgestani reporting from West Palm Beach in Florida. And Ketevan, who's also been to Georgia, which is another one of those swing states. We talked about Pennsylvania earlier. It's a pleasure and an honor to welcome another man who's running for office. You're running for re-election, Congressman Glenn Ivey of Maryland. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You are a Democrat, a member of the House Judiciary, the House Ethics Committee.
Yes.
What's this election about?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's going to determine the fate of the nation, the direction of the nation, and the direction of the world. I think if Donald Trump wins, it's a very dramatic difference from a victory by Kamala Harris.
And is it about what? Because we've heard people, even the young people, telling us, you know, young people saying, we don't care too much about these rule of law issues and all that. We're more interested in the economy, and we think Trump's better.
Yeah, I think we have to, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time and make sure we're taking care of both of those things. The economy certainly is critical, and I think, frankly, the United States is doing pretty well on the economy. I know it hasn't gotten to everybody, and so there's concerns for people who are still struggling on the piggy bank issues. But overall, you know, inflation's coming down, unemployment's at historic lows. You know, we've been adding thousands of new jobs every month for about 50 months now. Things do seem to be going in the right direction. And the Fed cutting interest rates, again, I think is going to be a big step in the right direction. With respect to the democracy and rule of law issues, I think those are things you can underestimate until you lose them. And we want to make sure that doesn't happen, because we can see what happens with other countries when they lose the democracy and rule of law guidance that's been the hallmark of the United States for so many years now.
They regret them when they lose them. Are people kind of sleepwalking into something? You were not yet a congressman on January the 6th, 2021, but you have long experience on Capitol Hill. When you walk around this city today, is it almost forgotten about? Because from across the Atlantic, we're wondering why this isn't more of an issue.
Well, I think it depends on which sector of the country you're talking to or talking about. I'm African-American. When I was a young man, the country was still segregated. I know what it's like to not be able to vote. I know what it's like to be unable to go to certain schools and certain stores and the like. And, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember the world before Roe v. Wade, and it's sad to see that again, women in a generation who've lost the rights that their grandparents and mothers had. It's easy for us to move in the wrong direction if we're not careful.
We see a growing gender divide over this issue of reproductive rights. What happens to the women's movement if Donald Trump is elected?
Well, it's hard to say, but I think it strengthens it in some ways, certainly in the states where those rights have been taken away already, and it could get worse. There are certainly states who are looking to take away abortion rights, even in the cases of rape and incest. And I'm sure there's going to be a national effort by the Republicans to make that a nationwide ban. So it's going to be a big fight. I think even if Harris wins, there's going to be a push by the Republicans to do that. Having the White House in Democratic hands, I think, makes it easier for us to fend that off and restore the rights of women's right to choose.
Glenn Ivey, you're an attorney, former attorney general for the state of Maryland. Donald Trump in the last few days, would you characterize his remarks as veiled threats against, say, the former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, the press, or are they actual threats? Should they be prosecuted?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, he's been making threats like that for years now, unfortunately.
Are they veiled?
I think they're pretty straightforward. You know, whether, you know, legally you have to have the ability to carry it out immediately, so it's not going to be a criminal prosecution, but he still has three of those left that are over his head, so it's not like he'll be out of the clear. But I think the bigger point, though, is that if he gets control of the government, the Army and Department of Justice, he can misuse them. In fact, in the last administration that he had, the only thing that kept that from really getting out of control were members of the cabinet, Secretary of Defense, refusing to seize ballots or have the military used to suppress peaceful, nonviolent demonstrations. So making sure that that doesn't happen, or that he doesn't weaponize prosecutors to go after his enemies that he's put a list out about, that's the stuff that we have to worry about.
How strong are institutions? Is there a plan if he's elected?
Yeah, there's a fight that'll have to happen, but I think we've seen that, you know, he pushed it to the brink when he was in office in 2017 and through 2021. We don't want to see that again. We want to make sure that we just keep him out of office, defeat him here at the ballot box, and we won't have to worry about this, those issues. We can begin to repair the rule of law and democracy here in the United States.
Congressman Ivey, you mentioned all those court cases that are still pending. If Kamala Harris is the winner, should she pardon the former president?
I don't think so, no. And she could only pardon the federal cases, so there are two state cases that are moving forward. And I don't think the governors in those states should pardon him either. He should be held accountable for what he's done. That's happened in a couple of cases already with respect to the civil liability for sexual assault and the corporate fraud that his company committed. And I think he will be held accountable in the remaining four criminal cases.
So just to be clear, does that mean he should go to jail?
I think so. I mean, you know, he's talked about two tiers of justice. The tier that he's on, he's complaining about being overly prosecuted. If he'd committed all of these things as a regular person, not only would he not be allowed to run for office, he'd have trouble getting the job. So I don't think being in the White House and being the president of the United States, he shouldn't be eligible for that. The acts that he's committed already should disqualify him from holding the presidency.
But your U.S. judiciary system is slow.
Yeah, you know, he gets due process. He gets the rule of law rights that he complains about not having. He still gets them anyway, but I think he'll still be held accountable ultimately.
Ultimately. What are your constituents telling you? What is highest on their minds?
There's a lot. Certainly they want to have Kamala Harris in the White House. Certainly they want to have better opportunities with respect to the economy, grocery and gas prices. They want to continue to see those come down, unemployment and jobs. I think they want to see more of those. And I think they want to see things happen that allow them to live, you know, take care of rent and mortgage, have their kids have opportunities to thrive, go to get education and get good jobs. The stuff that we've always wanted, but we've been having to fight about lately.
I asked about January the 6th earlier because January the 6th, 2021, it was the moment where both houses of Congress meet to certify the election, normally a formality. The U.S. vice president refused to sway, and Donald Trump had to exit the White House.
Yeah.
It'll be the new Congress that will certify the election this time. What will happen if Republicans are in control for that certification process?
I think certification will still happen, provided that we win the majority of the states that we need to get the 270-plus votes in the Electoral College. You're still going to have Trump and others complaining that the election was stolen. But at some point, I think we have to, again, hold them accountable and make sure they follow the rule of law and basic democracy. You know, if you lose, you vacate office and permit the peaceful transfer of power, or in this sense, it's a peaceful continuation of power with the Democratic Party from Biden to Harris.
One final question for you. What are the tea leaves we should be reading? What should we be looking for throughout this day? What are you looking at?
Well, I mean, in some ways, I'm not in a battleground state. Maryland is deeply blue, and, you know, clearly Harris is going to win there. But some of the states that are going to be in play, Pennsylvania is a big one. But there are others that have gotten interesting very recently, like Iowa. If Harris wins those states, you know, this could be a blowout. So we'll see.
You think that's really possible?
We'll see. You know, it's up to the voters to decide. It feels like a toss-up to me, but when I saw that poll that had her up in Iowa, that was astonishing to me. So we'll see.
Glenn Ivey, many thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Appreciate it.
The election has been sometimes fraught in a lot of places. We talked about battleground states, about Pennsylvania, about Georgia. There's also the case of Arizona, where we can cross now to France 24's Wassim Cornet. Wassim, tell us where you are. Oh, we're going to cross over to Wassim in a little bit. Let's cross to Lila Jacinto. Lila, you're in another battleground state, Michigan. Exactly where?
Must win Michigan, Francois. And I'm in the Motor City. Where I am right now is a vote counting center, the Huntington Place. This center was in the media spotlight in the last election in 2020,
so
when Stop the Steal, Stop the Count protesters descended here. But this time, everything's different. It is security has been tightened because the lessons of the 2020 election have been learned. And I was earlier at a polling station. Francois, you'll be happy to know this because this is the Motor City, Detroit, the automobile industry. This is also the home of Motown. And the polling stations were playing Motown music. So there's a good spirit here.
A good spirit. You've been out and about, Leela, and Michigan is one of those states where every vote is going to count. It's also home to a large, as you were saying, home to factory workers, but also to a large Palestinian American and an Arab American community. How are they going to swing?
Well, this is a very interesting thing to watch. I was in Dearborn. This is called the Arab American capital. And so there are a lot of people of Palestinian origin, of Lebanese origin as well. In fact, their senator, Rashida Tlaib, is of Palestinian origin, and she's running for re-election in Congress right now, not Senate. And what Arab American voters, this is an interesting one to watch, is that they are a Democratic stronghold. You know, they've always voted Democratic. But this time, a lot of Arab American voters have told me that they really want to punish Kamala Harris in the polls for the Biden administration's policies on Israel's war in Gaza and Lebanon. Now, just to give you a sense of the numbers, in 2020, Hillary Clinton lost Michigan by 10,000 votes. So every vote is important in this battleground state of Michigan. And earlier this year, there was an uncommitted movement, mostly of Arab American voters, who voted uncommitted in the primaries in order to give a message to the Democratic Party that they really would like, one, a ceasefire and tying Israeli military aid to Israel with a ceasefire. And that, it was called the Uncommitted Movement. And they set out to get 10,000 votes in the primary, 10,000 being the amount of votes Michigan was lost in 2016. And they got 100,000 votes. So the Arab American votes could very well sway this critical state here.
And there'll be a lot of suspense at that polling counting center where you are. Leela Jacinto reporting live from Detroit, Michigan. We're in the company now of John Conway. I want to thank you for joining us. You have being a Republican in your DNA. Yet you've this time been campaigning for Kamala Harris. Michigan, one of those places you went to. First off, let's begin with Michigan. What was it like when you went?
Yeah, we took our Republican Voters Against Trump campaign on the road. We went through Pennsylvania and Michigan, and we wanted to let the communities in Michigan know that there are Republican voters, not only in the state of Michigan, but across the country, who will be supporting Kamala Harris this November because they understand that Donald Trump is categorically unfit to be in office, and they don't love everything about Kamala Harris. They don't agree 100% with what Kamala Harris stands for, but they understand that Donald Trump is somebody who tried to overthrow our democracy on January 6th. They understand that Donald Trump has become even more extreme since the last time he's been on the ballot, and they're going to reject him today because they're going to put our country over our party. And so even though they're Republicans and even though they don't agree 100% with Kamala Harris, they're going to vote for her today regardless.
The inflation that spiked post-pandemic has since subsided, but people we've been speaking to saying, look, I'm getting battered. That's why I'm going to vote for Trump. And what did you say to people in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania when they gave you that answer?
Yeah, we've been doing focus groups with swing voters all cycle. And one of the common refrains we hear from some voters who are interested in voting for Trump is exactly that. It's the economy and it's immigration. And ultimately, we've had some strong economic numbers come out, and especially during this recovery over the last year out of COVID, the United States has been one of the leaders in terms of global recovery, but voters still aren't feeling the effects of that. And ultimately, the pitch we're making to voters is that, you know, policy and the economic stability of the country right now, we can always work on that, right? We can always change direction. We can always continue to work for the betterment of the American people. But Donald Trump is somebody who doesn't care about the American people. He only cares about himself. He's on the campaign trail right now talking about his own grievances, his own legal battles, his own feuds with his enemies. He's talking about his enemies list. Kamala Harris is fighting for the American people, and she has a plan in place in order to make our lives better. And Donald Trump only wants to make his life better, and that's why he's running for president this time.
No matter what country you're in, politics are always a bit tribal. You're with, like you support a sports team your whole life, you support a party generally your whole life. What was the moment where you, John Conway, thought, wait a minute, I have to cross the aisle here? What was the moment, the moment?
I've always thought that Donald Trump was somebody who does not represent the best of America or the best of the Republican Party. And I think when he launched his nomination in 2015, he did so by attacking immigrants and attacking people that were coming to the United States for a better life. And I think that the Republican Party that I cherish is the one of Ronald Reagan, where he said the United States is a shining city on a hill. And Donald Trump doesn't represent that vision of America. Donald Trump is somebody who fundamentally hates America. He says that we're garbage. He says that everything is turning against him and against this country. And I think, you know, the Republican Party that I believe in is one that stands for free markets, leadership, and supporting our democracy at home and abroad. And Donald Trump doesn't represent any of those values, and that's why I could never support him.
You say you support free markets. How much of a minority view is that these days when the most pressing issue for many on the international stage is a rivalry with China, which is accused of unfairly subsidizing its industry?
Well, see, Donald Trump has fundamentally changed the Republican Party in this respect. He's talking about, you know, slapping 100, 200% tariffs on goods, not only from China, but around the world. And what he doesn't understand is...
And there's been a continuity. Joe Biden has not reversed Donald Trump's policies.
Well, there's been some tariffs that the Biden administration has kept, especially strategic tariffs. But Donald Trump, what he's proposing is flat tariffs across the board. And I think that we can deal with the challenge of China while also promoting free trade around the world, because we know that our leaders are able to do that. We've done that in the past. And Donald Trump is somebody who doesn't fundamentally understand how to craft good policy in this regard. And that's why I think that Kamala Harris has a vision and a plan to make the United States better that also includes trade across the globe without putting 200% tariffs on goods. These don't have to be mutually exclusive things.
John Conway, 4 years ago, you know, each election cycle, we discover campaigning in a new form because of where the digital age goes so fast. And 4 years ago, the big social media groups pushed back against some of the disinformation that was spouted. That pushing back has now loosened, not just at Twitter, which was bought by Elon Musk, who supports Trump. My question to you is, can they regulate themselves, these tech companies, or is there going to be a need for the United States to review not only its politics, but the way it regulates the way information is disseminated?
I think it's really important for all of America to once again restore our value of free speech. And I think
that be done without a government regulation?
I think ultimately the free market and self-regulation on these tech companies is what's best. I think whenever you start mixing the government with speech, we know from history that there's a very dangerous slippery slope. And I think for the most part, these companies have standards that they need to be enforcing in terms of content moderation, but also
self-enforcing.
I think whenever we start mixing government authority with our free speech rights, that's a dangerous slope. And I think we need to let the free market of ideas ultimately decide. That's how it's always been in this country. And I think it's been that way for very good reasons, because it promotes the best freedom for all Americans to speak their mind without any government interference.
What's the biggest difference for you in the way the campaigns happened, unfolded, compared to 4 years ago?
This is obviously an unprecedented campaign, with Kamala Harris being the nominee for only 3 months. She had to reintroduce herself to the American people because there was a lot of voters across the country who weren't very familiar with who Kamala Harris was as her time as vice president. So I think she's running a really smart campaign with a positive vision. And Donald Trump is running a campaign not for the American people. This is a presidential campaign that exists in order for Donald Trump to go after his enemies and for him to benefit and for him to profit. And so I think America has a stark choice between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. And I think ultimately Kamala Harris is going to be successful today.
All right. There's a prediction. John Conway, so many thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
All right. John Conway, they're mentioning what he thinks is going to happen. Remember, we're going to have the polls closing later on during our special at 9 p.m. Washington time for most of the East Coast. That's when the focus will shift to where France 24's Wassim Cornet happens to be. You're in Phoenix, Arizona. Tell us where you are, Wassim.
Hey, good morning, Francois. Almost good afternoon from Phoenix, Arizona, from a polling station in northeastern Phoenix. Phoenix is the county seat of Maricopa County, which is the largest state in the state of in the state of Arizona. The most important state in terms of the swing states in the western United States, with its 11 electoral votes. Right off the bat, let me tell you, there have been some efforts online to try to convince voters that there are issues with at polling stations in Maricopa County, telling some people that voting stations are closed and that they are turning voters away. That is not true. So we are here to say right off the bat that voters are able to go to any polling station across the county to vote and cast their ballot. We have heard, however, of some issues in Apache County, that is in northeastern Arizona, mostly covering the Navajo Nation. Reports early this morning saying that several polling stations had voting machines that were not working. So the county officials there are asking voters to show up with their government ID and ask to cast a provisional ballot, and that will be counted later. But unfortunately, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but if we do see a very close race in some of those eastern states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Georgia, well, then we may be here for a while, because Arizona is notoriously slow when it comes to counting ballots. And also, it will be a very, very close race. Joe Biden won this state by less than 11,000 votes against Donald Trump 4 years ago. So and polls do suggest that it will be another close one, although Donald Trump does seem to be having a slight edge when you average all of the polls. But voters across the state, in Maricopa County in particular, are asked to cast their ballot in a number of races, from the presidency, of course, to a key Senate race, Ruben Gallego on the Democratic side, Kerry Lake on the Republican side, but also small local races like the mayor of Phoenix, like the next supervisors on the school district board, the board members of the Central Arizona Water Conservation District, and also statewide 13 propositions. Those are citizen-driven ballot initiatives that are on the ballot on a range of issues. The two main ones this election day, Proposition 314 on immigration, which among many other things, would make it a state crime to cross into Arizona outside of those official ports of entry, and would allow state and local police to arrest anyone found guilty of doing that. And Proposition 139, that is abortion. That would enshrine abortion as a constitutional right in the state of Arizona. Abortion, of course, present on the ballot in Arizona and 9 other states across the country. Democrats, progressists, hoping to galvanize supporters of abortion to show up at polling stations across the country, vote to enshrine abortion rights in the Constitution, and of course to vote as well for Kamala Harris.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the telling issues. Will it be those turning out for that anti-immigration initiative, or those turning out for that reproductive rights initiatives who win the day? Wassim Cornet, many thanks for that live update from Phoenix, Arizona. It's a pleasure to see her in the flesh. Christine Brezina from the Atlantic Council, how are you?
Excellent. How are you?
All right. We've been harassing Christina a lot since February of 2022, when Vladimir Putin launched his all-out invasion of Ukraine. When it comes to foreign policy, the whole world is, of course, watching, and in particular, your native Ukraine.
Absolutely. So it is a really big issue in this election. How does the foreign policy question get resolved? In some ways, it's a question about what happens next in Ukraine. Is there going to be an acceleration towards a ceasefire or a peace negotiation? Or is there going to be more time for Ukraine to make progress on the battlefield? And is that going to be a question of months? Or are we looking at a question of years? That's a question probably between Trump and between Harris.
And some are suggesting that even if Kamala Harris wins the election, Congress has, in effect, signed its last check for military aid to Ukraine. Is that your view?
I think that's really hard to say. In some ways, we get into a different political moment after this election, after today. Then it comes back to a question of what is the American role, what are American values? I think it's not impossible for there actually to be more military aid between the middle of November and the end of the year. But so much depends on this election. So much depends upon the decisions that American people make today. But when I travel around the country, when I talk to Iowan farmers or military service members or people working on the energy side of things in the Appalachians, a lot of European issues make sense. I don't think you can say that there is a red foreign policy or a blue foreign policy, and I think there's a lot of nuance in the American people. And so in some ways it's oversimplified in the Washington conversation, but I think whether you have a Trump or a Harris presidency is going to really also change what that dynamic is like on the ground.
Is Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, ready for a return of Donald Trump to the White House? Should that be the case?
I think so. I think that perhaps in 2016 there was a surprise with Trump coming into power, but we're not in 2016.
So Zelensky has a plan, because let's listen to what Donald Trump had to say on the campaign trail.
Inflation wouldn't have happened. Russia-Ukraine wouldn't have happened. Israel wouldn't have happened. The October 7th Israel attack would have never happened. Those people would all be alive.
So he'll sit both sides down on day one, says Donald Trump. So is Volodymyr Zelensky ready for that? It's going to affect mean sitting down and conceding territory.
Absolutely. Sorry. So there is a real chance that there need to be a face-to-face conversation very soon. But this is not a surprise. This is something that Ukrainians and Europeans have been thinking about for the last few months. The fact that the reality as it is in the middle of November might be the military reality that is the reality that is dealt with around a negotiation table has been clear. The question is, what are the political options on the table? And that's why I think when you look at Zelensky's peace plan, the question of NATO is so important there, right? There's a military reality and there's a political menu. And everyone going into this election from the European side, from the Ukrainian side, is aware of who they might have to deal with. And that's why having an expansive lift, a list and a high lift of what things that Ukrainians might want has been put out there. And the Ukrainians will have to advocate for themselves as much as possible.
This Tuesday is Election Day in the United States. Yes. This Thursday, there's a European Council summit. And it's a tradition that every 6 months, there's a new country that's the rotating chair of the European Council. This time, it happens to be the most pro-Trump of the 27 members of the bloc, Hungary. And it'll be taking place in Budapest. What are going to be the optics come Thursday if we're still in this position of indecision where we don't know who's winning and Viktor Orban congratulates Donald Trump? Will that just be a bit of political theater?
I think we can expect there to be lots of warm words from Viktor Orban towards Trump, whether or not he is up or undecided or down. That is a relationship that has been steady throughout the past few years. And so that is an expectation. I think there's going to be a lot of caution from other European leaders if we don't know exactly who is up or who is down in the polls. But again, just because there's a rotating presidency and just because Orban has the floor, I think that there's not much of a sense that he speaks on behalf of all of Europe. He is an individual on the European political scene, and I don't think there will be a misunderstanding on the American side should he say something that is not in line with what the other leaders say.
And Christina, finally asking for a friend. France has right now kind of a hung parliament situation. We're probably going to have another snap election at some point soon. And the National Rally, which is also pro-Trump, the far-right party, is tipped to make yet more gains. Again, what the result here, how much does that weigh on European politics?
Europe is going to have to deal with a different United States after the next few months. Whether that's a Trump United States or a Harris United States, it's hard to say. In either way, the responsibility for Europe to do more for its own security and defense and to show the fact that it is investing in developing its economy and its security and defense is going to be very important. It really doesn't matter whether that is Trump or that is Harris. The notion that the shifting of ambition on security has to happen to Europe no matter what, and whether that's Rally or someone else on the French side, also doesn't necessarily matter. Someone is going to have to protect Europe. The Americans are there. The Americans are going to continue to be there in some form, but the fact that there is ever more pressure for Europeans to do more, for France to do more, for itself, whoever is in charge, is going to exist.
All right, Christina Brezina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Great to see you. So, the whole world is indeed watching. Christina Brezina of the Atlantic Council telling us as much. We're going to cross in a moment to William Galston, who will give us his views on all of this, longtime commentator. Situation in those swing states, it's a difficult one to find out what's going to happen. Just a reminder, if you're joining us here on France 24, we're at the midway point of voting in the United States. As was said at the outset, we had the polls opening in Hawaii, and it'll be interesting to watch, of course, at the end whether or not we'll be waiting on results from Alaska and Hawaii to determine who the next president is. It's that close. Christina, again, thank you so much for being with us. So we'll be talking in a moment with William Galston about these issues. William Galston, who is a longtime watcher on domestic and foreign policy, and also a member, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. In fact, here he comes now. Watch the sunlight. Well, thanks for being with us here. Come this way.
Okay,
how are we looking? Are we looking good? Okay, just point your shoulders at the camera. A bit of live television prepping here. First of all, what was your gut instinct when your alarm clock rang this morning, or did you not need one?
Well, my gut instinct was that the past week has been a pretty good week for Kamala Harris and a pretty bad week for Donald Trump. So my gut instinct was that Harris was in a stronger position than she was a week ago. Whether that will be strong enough, I can't tell you.
But gut instincts change throughout the day, I've noticed.
Yeah, mine hasn't changed today. That's probably because I've just been looking at the same numbers I was looking at last night.
Right. What's going on with democracy in America?
Well, I can describe it very simply. Through a period of historical evolution now that's gone on for a full generation, the United States is both closely divided and deeply divided. And it turns out that that is a very bad combination for trying to govern effectively in a system of checks and balances, not a parliamentary system where if you win, you win everything.
What is that about? Is that just sheer luck that you have people on the divide, if you will, on both sides that are roughly even? Is it an institutional problem with this constitution that's sometimes difficult to explain, drawn up in the 18th century? What's it about?
Well, in part, it's about deep cleavages on issues ranging from economics to culture that have developed and widened over the period of generation. It's also the case that both parties have gotten increasingly good at slicing and dicing the electorate. So
it's called micro-targeting?
Exactly, to get as close to a majority as possible. And so the technology of politics has helped contribute to the narrowing of the gap between the two parties. But in part, it's because of our system that has divided the country into states whose total electoral votes are pretty evenly balanced. I can remember in a close election that I remember, the first one that I remember of 1960, 35 states were swing states. Most of the country was within a very narrow margin. Now we have some states that are very Republican, some states that are very Democratic, and just a handful that are truly contested. And that's one of the things that's made the elections so close.
Yeah, and those political parties are changing. You mentioned the 1960s. It was a time when the Democratic Party had a stronghold in the South, and there was a sort of a generational change, perhaps even a change of a more than a century, where the allegiances flipped. A half century later, I ask, could allegiances flip again? Are we seeing some kind of redrawing of the political map, or did it already happen in 2016?
It didn't start to happen in 2016. It was accelerated in 2016, but it hasn't stopped. And previously, you could talk about this in regional terms. Now you need to talk about it in class terms. Increasingly, highly educated people are gravitating towards the Democratic Party. People without college educations are heading quickly towards the Republican Party. And as we've learned from politics, not just in the United States, but all over the Democratic West, a college education comes with a particular set of outlooks, willingness to deal with diversity, willingness to deal with change, a preference for urban life, and increasingly people without college educations are less comfortable with diversity, less comfortable with change, and less comfortable with urban life. And so you see an urban-rural split, you see an education split, and you see an occupational split. The United States is not distinctive in this respect.
Not distinctive in this respect. One of the questions you asked, and it'll be my last one to you, you're wondering, Donald Trump, people thought, he's finished after 2020. Now you're wondering, can he create a multi-ethnic working class party?
This is the great question, because the Republicans shifted to being a party of educated white people to a party of less educated white people. But white working class voters are not a majority in the country, and they keep on shrinking as a share of the population. What Donald Trump is trying to do is to create within the Republican Party a working class coalition across ethnic and racial lines. If he succeeds in doing that, and this election will be a test of that, though maybe not the last test, then he will have completely reconfigured American politics, and this will be the new axis of division for the next generation.
And like you say, perhaps something that will influence as well the politics of Europe and beyond. William Galston, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
And we're going to be, of course, continuing with our live coverage throughout the United States. Live coverage on election night. Join us Wednesday for another special edition of the France 24 debate from Washington.